Jeff Jackson joins us on the phone. Hello, Jeff. How are you?
Good, Bob. How are you doing?
Well, sir. The first item of interest is before the deal was officially announced, it was reported, and I say that in quotations, that McDavid's deal would be $13.25 million. It came in at $12.5 million. It was then speculated that Connor, out of some benevolence, took a $750,000 a year haircut over a contract that was offered. Can you clarify whether that is accurate or not?
Well, what I said yesterday in Edmonton and what Peter said at the press conference and which was echoed by Connor is that that number was, you know, it was floated out there. It was reported by very credible people. You know, the negotiation wasn't finished. It had some things that we had to get through, structure and different things. And part of what we had to get through was where everybody felt comfortable, including Connor. And at the end of the day, we ended up at the average of 12.5, and everybody's happy. And the people in Edmonton who run the team and own the team are thrilled, and Connor's thrilled. And for me, that's the most important thing, that my client's happy.
It has also been reported that a significant portion of the contract will be paid in signing bonuses. Is that accurate?
Yes, that's accurate.
And can you explain to the audience, if you will, what the advantages are of that exercise? I know I've gone through it personally in contracts that I have signed, but I think the average person would be intrigued by why the decision to go with signing bonuses rather than in salary.
Well, in the contract, it's because of the length of it. It's going to, you know, it's going to span the end of the current collective bargaining agreement. And there's a couple of years that there's a potential for a lockout. We've had a couple of those obviously in the past when the agreements come to an end. This current agreement has a provision that allows for early termination by either party with notice a year prior. So it could conceivably be ending in 3 years instead of five. But there's a contingency in there with the signing bonuses that, you know, if you get paid your signing bonus earlier in the year, calendar year, then the lockout would take place. So you would get paid prior to the lockout.
Right.
And so in that way, you avoid losing all of your compensation for that year. That's one thing. And then, you know, it's just the value of having your money up front and working for you. The fact that you can't, signing bonus amounts are not subject to buyout. I don't ever foresee Connor McDavid being bought out by the Edmonton Oilers. But, you know, my job as an agent and lawyer is to just try to cover off contingencies. So that's the way, that's why we structured it that way. And it's unique. I think Steven Stamkos' contract last year was very heavily weighted in signing bonus. And there's been others in the past, so it's not unique that way. I think it might be probably the most, but it's not unique in structure.
If there is a, this is just a hypothetical, but you can help me with this. If there is a work stoppage, either by the players or by the league, as you say, by having a signing bonus, a player is guaranteed to get paid over that period of time if he's on a straight salary. If there are no games, he doesn't play, he doesn't get paid during that period. Some players would suffer greatly in terms of their economic reality as a result of that contingency. But let me give you a hypothetical that I don't know has ever taken place. What if there was a lockout that lasted more than one calendar year? So McDavid would get July 1st, he gets his signing bonus paid. So he is covered during a year of a lockout. If July 1st of the next year rolled around and the lockout was ongoing, would he get paid again?
Well, I've structured it in a way that I believe that he would. There's precedent in the past through league mediations. I think it was the Bobby Hajdúk case many, many years ago. So I don't, you know, that's a, that is a hypothetical that I guess could happen. It's unlikely, but in, you know, past history has shown that the signing bonus, even if you're kind of caught the next year, would be payable. But again, you know, as these things play out over time, you know, the parties have to get together on things, and sometimes parties don't agree on interpretations of things. That's the way it is now, and that's the way that I foresee it happening. But I also think that the chances of that happening are pretty remote.
Sure, I understand. I just wondered about the legality of that, whether he gets paid regardless, or whether all you are able to protect is that first year of a lockout or work stoppage.
Yeah. Well, we've tried to protect, you know, that contingency, that hypothetical, and we think that precedent has shown that that would be he would get his signing bonus in the lockout. But again, you know, I hope that that never happens for the sake of the game, and you know, for the sake of all of our players and our business, and for fans. It's just, you know, having a lockout that long is a horrible thing. It just never really seems to help anybody.
Well, no, I mean, any lockout of any length of time is concerning. I would agree, and something that lasted that long would be it has hurt other sports as well as hockey.
Yeah.
When it's happened, it doesn't really help.
Yeah.
Having said that. Again, I'm very much into the hypotheticals here. Right now, the cap is projected to be at $75 million. Let's put escrow in the back pocket here and not talk much about escrow, because that always confuses people. But and we haven't seen a scenario, I don't recall, Jeff, I don't know if you do, where the cap has actually gone down. I don't remember one. Do you?
The cap went down when they reset at the last lockout. If you recall, it went.
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah. Right? I understand.
Other than that, it has not gone down, and it was flat. I'm trying to think of the year. I think it might have been the third or fourth year of the cap being in place. So it would have been like 07, 08, or 08, 09. It only went up 100,000.
Yeah, but it went up something.
It went up a little bit,
yeah,
and but it's never gone down other than the reset and the last lockout. So, no, it hasn't.
So let me give you a couple of things. The maximum a team can pay any one player is 20% of the cap. Correct?
Right.
So that would be $15 million. So Connor is significantly under that. But what happens if one of two things happens? The cap goes down substantially, which we don't expect to happen, but what if it does? Or conversely, what if in the next negotiation, the percentages are changed? What if the owners come back and say you can only pay any one player 15% of the cap? How does a player current like Connor, and there aren't many of them, but there would be a handful of players in the NHL who that might affect. What then? Do you know?
Well, I don't know. I would assume that it would be on the PA and their executive, which would include, you know, players, and the players all have a voice, that those players are protected, grandfathered in, however you want to say it. It's happened in the past where deals have been kind of grandfathered through.
Yeah.
And made it, you know, there's an exception made for the exception. And so that would be, you know, to me, that's a logical way it would get handled. I don't think that they would ever be in a position to try to roll back a contract that conformed to all the rules and was negotiated between two parties and agreed upon. And it would be a very unlikely scenario that the PA would ever fold or agree to something like that.
With Jeff Jackson, he is an agent with the Orr Group, and they represent Connor McDavid, who just signed an 8-year contract extension worth $100 million. Of that, a reported, well, in excess of $85 million would be paid in signing bonuses. And Jeff has gone through the process of why the deal is structured that way. Do you believe that this is, I think things in all parts of negotiations go in waves. Agents, representatives come up with ideas and ways to structure contracts that become appealing to others. Are we in a wave of, like with every player, you're going to try and get as much as you can in a signing bonus?
Well, like I mentioned earlier, Bob, I don't, this concept is not really new. There's been players that have been doing this over the years.
Sure.
It's a little bit more prevalent lately. I think that, like you said, it's part of negotiations, and I think it all depends on the relative leverage of each party. And in our case, you know, structure was important, as I mentioned. So when speculation was out there about numbers and different things, we wanted a certain structure, and we got the structure that we wanted. And I think that sometimes there's give and take, as you know, in negotiations, and sometimes teams will give the signing bonus if the money's less. I don't think you get all everything you want ever in negotiations. So again, it's just a negotiated point, and it's something that's been around for a while. And I think that probably people will continue to try to do it, and it'll be, you know, up to the parties in their, you know, individual negotiations to hammer that out.
I'm a big believer in the reality that the tide raises all ships. In this case, Connor McDavid is the leading edge of the tide. His contract is the largest in terms of annual stipend, I believe, in NHL history. Do you have a sense of whether this actually moves the needle? Does this impact on other premier players in terms of what they can get? Nobody is at the cap. Nobody's at $15 million. The best players in the game, for whatever reason, have chosen to take less than the maximum, when you could make the argument that if they stood firm, they could get the maximum. Connor McDavid may have been one of those guys. Maybe one of those guys who, if he really wanted to, could have said, I'm worth 20%. I'm worth $15 million. Certainly, Crosby is a guy who I think he's making 9 or 9.5 or something like that. Hard to believe that he couldn't have, on his last negotiation, gotten absolute max dollars. Even the two guys in Chicago who signed for a lot of money, 10, 5 or something a year, you can make the argument that they're good enough to kind of get cap space. Do you think this moves the bar in any way, Jeff?
I do. I think that there's two things here that are a little distinguishing. First, about the system, and then about Connor's circumstance. And the first, you know, the system is unlike basketball and baseball, with certain exceptions to the cap, soft cap, salary, soft cap, salary cap system, or the in baseball where you have a luxury tax. I mean, the NHL system is a hard cap. There's no flexibility. That in and of itself causes issues for teams to build winning teams. You see Steph Curry signed for $40 million and you know, there's speculation in baseball that there could be a $500 million contract coming down the pipe soon. And those teams are allowed to go over, you know, the, I guess it's an artificial cap because they can go over it, but the money is then spread around amongst the other teams in the league.
So, yeah, there are penalties to be paid for,
right,
that.
Right, there's penalties. And they can be significant, but that's a decision the team makes on their own, and they factor that in. So in hockey, you don't have that. So that's capped the players, like you mentioned, at a lower amount. All of those players that you mentioned, too, signed their current contracts at a time when they were, I'd say, approaching their late 20s, so 27, 28, 29, and 8-year deals, and in Sidney's case it was 12. So he's into his mid-30s by the time that his contract ends. And those were heavily weighted front end. I think Jonathan Toews and Pat Kane's deals, they averaged 10.5, but in their first 3-4 seasons they were paid 13.8, and then they declined somewhat and bring the average value down. Connor's, like you said, if he's at the edge of a new wave, it's because these young guys are such good players and they're dominant so early. And they're going to be in the prime of their career through their, you know, early 20s to their late 20s when their contracts end. So we kind of went through something in the last couple of years where you see you see Connor and Matthews and Eichel and Werenski and all these really great young kids step into the league and really play dominant roles on their team. So the conventional thinking and the conventional way of doing things, waiting for that third deal to actually, you know, kick in for these guys, I think is changing. And this is what part of the discussion that Peter and I had throughout the negotiations. And I don't know if it'll change, but I suspect that it probably will.
Peter Chiarelli, I assume you're referring to.
Yes.
Two quick things before I let you go, Jeff, and I thank you for your time. One of the things that I have talked about here, and I'm a proponent of, first of all, I like dynasties. I like greatness. I think we all watch sports to see greatness. We don't watch to see competitive balance. We want to see greatness. And the older you get, the more you realize that the only things you will remember about a lifetime of watching sport are those great moments and great teams. So I'm, Mr. Bettman doesn't like it, but I tell him the competitive balance is of no consequence to me whatsoever. So with that in mind, one of the things that I have proposed is the ability of teams who are not at the cap to trade cap space with teams who are at the cap. In other words, if a team has $10 million of cap space and they're not going to use it for economic reasons or whatever, they have the ability to acquire assets, tangible players, or draft picks or whatever in exchange for that cap space. First of all, do you like that idea?
Yeah, conceptually, it's a good idea. And I think that, you know, when I worked for the Leafs and I worked with Brian Burke, he was a proponent of something similar where you could trade some cap space. I think that the system, I like that idea. I think the system needs some flexibility in it to allow for teams that have gone through whatever they've gone through, whether it's the Toronto Maple Leafs for many, many years or the Edmonton Oilers for many, many years, and then all of a sudden they have an opportunity to have a dynasty-type team or a very exciting team with young stars and have them for a long time.
And you can't keep it together.
You can't keep it together. I think that it's a system that if that's the way the system is, then it's just like a roundabout. It just continues to, cycle, and you don't have the ability to have a fan base get excited and they suffer for many, many years. Why can't they enjoy it for many, many years?
Well, I agree.
That's kind of my philosophy.
The last question I will ask you, and I'm putting you a bit on the spot here. Last week, we had two separate agents on, player agents, one of whom expressed concerns about the transparency of the National Hockey League Players Association and the inability of to get answers to questions. Another agent, quite frankly, told us that he doesn't see that as an issue, at least for him personally. We know of three agents who have gone public already and said they have concerns. Would you like to voice on that subject?
I'd actually prefer just to keep my opinion private about it. I've talked to many, many agents in the game also, and I know I listened to both of those interviews, and I'm well aware of the positions of each of those different parties. I think the important thing for us as advocates for the players is that we make sure that we get ourselves united, and we have a plan, and we're gonna stick to it, and it's gonna have some contingencies in it. So I think that those agents who brought forth concerns are creating a dialogue. Alan Walsh always has a strong opinion, and I respect that. And that also fosters more discussion. So I think that, whether I land on one side or the other of where these positions are, I think it's good that we're talking about it and we're not kind of just have our head in the sand and then it pops up, a year before the collective agreement's done, and then we have this thing happening then. So,
well, can you tell us, is that dialogue taking place even on a casual basis, telephone calls, et cetera?
Yeah. There's lots of discussion, but it's not, it's not an undermining of the Players Association. It's just more of a discussion about, addressing what's been brought forward and what's been opined on and how, we all as a group, you mentioned three guys and another agent. Well, there's four of many, many agents who represent many, many players. So we all don't stand, you know, exactly behind what they're saying, but there's lots of different opinion out there. And I think that it's created a very good environment to talk about it amongst us and with our players too.
Yeah,
so,
sure.
And most importantly, educating them to what's going on and to ask questions and get clarification. And, you know, Alan Walsh is right. You know, if you want to find out information, you can get in your car or walk down to the Players Association, go up to the office, and they'll sit down with you and they'll answer the questions. I don't see that as a problem. But I think this is good for the process that we've got, like, a dialogue going on.
Well, we'll keep an eye on it, if you will. And we thank you for your time today and your candor. And congratulations to you and to Connor and everybody at the OR Group. And thank you very much for joining us.
It was my pleasure. Thanks.
Jeff Jackson is an agent for the OR Group. He represents Connor McDavid.